ages, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 667 of Unwelcome Guests. Community successes, restoring our connection to the land. I'm Robin Upton. It's a contrast with last week's show, a range of speakers this time looking not at the actions of the powers that be and how to resist them, but alternative things that we could be doing ourselves, specifically growing food and community. We begin with the following piece, which was posted to the Sheffield Indie Media site in the UK, entitled Community Successes, An Evening with Rob Hopkins.
I'm going to just kind of give you a bit of an overview, really, of what transition is, and an update. If you've already been involved in this for a while, hopefully it's a bit of an update. If you're new to this, then hopefully it will also be an introduction, and we'll have time at the end for questions, and we'll take it from there. I like to kind of start with this picture at the moment. This looks like an everyday scene. A man walking his dog down the high street, past the butchers. But actually, if you look at it a little bit closer, these hams, sort of cut and paste, kind of repeated things appear in the window. It all doesn't quite look as it should. This is in a place called Belcoo in Northern Ireland. And it's a small town on the route where the G8 ministers were driven from their airport to their five-star luxury golfing retreat where their summit took place last week. And in Belcoo, thanks largely, some might say, directly to the policies of the G8, many of the shops, the former independent shops that would have made up the economy of that town, are now boarded up. In order for the G8, bless their hearts, to be able to drive through Belcoo without witnessing any of this, these enormous stickers were created to cover the windows of the shops. And the next one along was a delicatessen, and it had a kind of a photoshopped delivery boy bicycle with a basket on the front, pretend leaning against the window. We had a launch last night in Totnes, and my son was there, and he said, "Is that a real door? Because you can actually see the butcher's shoulder here. Kind of, there's a sort of a virtual pretend Photoshop butcher behind his counter there." What really struck me about this, and there's a couple of things that struck me, I'll come back to one of them later on, but one of the things that struck me is it really kind of reflected the sort of state of collective denial that we live in at the moment. But actually, rather than saying, "Oh dear, well, what are we going to do about this? You know, we've got an economy here that's sort of turned up its toes. I wonder what the reasons for that are. What can we do about it?" We slap a sticker on and make it look like a butcher shop, even though the same hams repeat and it's obviously not real. You know, we kind of live rather in this sort of deluded state. So what I'd like to do is to go into some of the reasons for that and then how transition represents a response. So there are a few different things, I suppose, that really underpin transition as a response. And the first one is our addiction to oil. And one of the things that I did here today in Sheffield was go on BBC Radio Sheffield this afternoon. And just before I had my bit, the news was, the lead story was, Ofgem warn that the lights might go out in the UK within 2 years due to energy shortages. And then the next story was, Lancashire's got more gas that we can frack than we ever thought possible, and there's tons of it, and it's all going to be fine, and we can party again, and so on. The observation in transition from the very outset was that our addiction to fossil fuels, our dependency on fossil fuels, leaves us enormously precarious, leaves us very vulnerable and wobbling around in that kind of a way. We now know that conventional oil production peaked in 2006, and actually increasingly what is sustaining us is what's called unconventional oils. So whether it's the tar sands in Alberta, in northern Canada, which environmentally are catastrophic, and it's like trying to extract the cocoa back out of an enormous chocolate brownie It's not like your mental picture might of getting oil out. It might be like in the Beverly Hillbillies where you stick a hole in the ground and out it comes. The Alberta tar sands are completely different. And the analogy that I used a while ago was it's like going into your favourite pub and the beer's off. And you're so desperate for a drink that you're looking at the carpet thinking, well, over the life of this pub, there must have been about 3,000 pints of beer spilt on that carpet, so we could boil up the carpet. You know, that's really what the tar sands are, energy-wise. And now in Alberta, they're talking about building nuclear power stations in order to provide the electricity, to provide the heat, to extract the really poor-grade oil out of the tar sands. It's absolutely mad. And the water that it uses, it's mad. And again, with gas fracking is the big thing here that everyone's getting terribly excited about. But even the companies themselves who are pushing gas fracking are admitting that even if all of their very rosy, very optimistic take on how much there is right, by 2018 they're going to be producing 10% of our national demand. And even a peak production in 2034 will be about 20%. But you have to look at that alongside the fact that North Sea oil and gas is now the most rapidly depleting oil and gas fields in the world. So it's not new, it's filling up this depleting kind of a gap. Really, the question is, how do we break that dependency? How do we break that addiction in a creative way that actually leaves us in a better place than where we start from now? Climate change is another thing that really underpins what transition is all about. And I think our analysis has always been that really, really responding to climate change means going beyond the idea that it's just about changing our light bulbs and driving a bit slower. When you really think it through, it's a profound crisis. You know, Nicola Stern said it represented the biggest market failure in history. And the 350.org argue that we know we have this much carbon in the ground. We've mapped the world. We know there's massive reserves of carbon. We don't need to go looking for any more. Because the science says if you want to stay below 2 degrees, you can only burn a fifth of it. And the rest of it has to stay in the ground anyway. So why do we go around looking for more? And actually, this four-fifths of what we know we have, that has to stay in the ground, our pension companies, our economy is built on the assumption that we'll be able to get this out. This is money that we're kind of assuming we've already spent. But we can't, because it's not going to be there. So there's this huge financial bubble lining up in terms of that, because we're not going to be able to extract that. So from a climate angle, it's the climate scientists that I talked to when I was researching the book, their analysis was we need to start cutting emissions 10% a year now, starting now, if we're going to turn this around. That goes far beyond the idea of sort of changing the light bulbs and those kind of tweaking things. It's a profound kind of shift in how we imagine things are going to work and the scale on which they're going to work. And I think in many ways, community groups like this are where the real thinking about what that's going to look like is coming from. Another thing I think that has come more recently into the transition way of thinking is about the economy. And one of the things that in many other countries, I think would have brought people out onto the streets in outrage, was a statistic that was in the Mary Portis review that came out last year, which said that, just as a kind of throwaway thing, and she didn't go back and say, well, that's not very good, is it? But that 97% of all groceries now sold in the UK are sold through 8,000 supermarket outlets. So if we just pick a figure, so if we just assume that therefore the other 3% represents the local independent economy, we know that that local independent 3% economy, for every pound that you spend in this economy, creates 3 times more jobs than every pound you spend in that one. This economy is the one that puts the money in and makes the village, makes the carnivals happen, the festivals happen, sends the local kids to school. You know, this is the one which there are various studies that even say that the more that is spent in this economy, the more people vote. You know, there's impacts in terms of social capital, the amount of groups you have in a community, all this kind of thing. So the question at the moment when we have an economy which is really struggling, I think, is do we aim to grow this one or do we aim to grow this one? Because this one only grows by shoving that one out of the way. And this one undermines the resilience in this community. It's very aggressive. It's quite happy. Every time a new supermarket opens, a large supermarket, on average 276 jobs are lost in this economy. And that impact is felt up to 15 kilometres from where that supermarket opens. So we have a real choice here, I think. And that's something that we'll come back to as well. And the last one is this idea about economic growth, that economies can just grow forever. We've had economic growth on and off for the last 50, 60 years, whatever. But do we assume, therefore, that it can always be there? Or actually, you know, one of the stories that I have in the book is about I went to a meeting of chief executive officers from all across the southwest of England. Every year they get away and they spend 2 days together and they chat and hang out, and it's all kind of Chatham House rules, so nothing is named, attributed to anybody. And we got asked to go and facilitate it. And for the opening discussion, you know, we did a thing, go around, who are you? Where are you from? What's your sense of where the economy is going to be in 5 or 10 years? Expecting all these people who are out there delivering the growth agenda to say, well, of course, it'll all be fine. 3/4 of them said, ain't going to happen. One of them said, this is the first generation, every generation up until now has had more than its parents. This is the first time that stops. Another one said, this is the beginning of what the decline of Western civilization looks like. This is so interesting. This is so interesting. If you're out in public, you'd be saying, yes, of course. But actually, a lot of the time when you get those people on their own, it's not, they don't believe it. So where does the thinking come from for what happens instead? Where does the thinking come from about what a post-growth economy might look like and the potential that it could actually meet our needs a lot better being designed around a 3% rather than 97%? Because ultimately, I would argue, there is no cavalry coming riding to the rescue in the places where we live. Government is kind of cutting more and more and more. So what does it fall? It falls to us to kind of get together with the people around us, as it has numerous times back through history as well. But I think in many ways that's a great thing. And that's why we call the book The Power of Just Doing Stuff. Because the more I talk to people around the world who are doing transition, who are kind of stepping up and doing this kind of thing, whether they call it transition or not, doesn't really matter. But this whole kind of wide kind of ecosystem of people getting on with it and doing stuff, there is a sense that actually they're taking power back that we've kind of lost over time. And so it's a very kind of empowering thing, I think. But when you encounter all of this stuff, you can feel very numb or depressed, or, you know, there's a whole range of emotions when we encounter these kind of things. And I think it's largely why we often don't do anything. We don't feel there's anyone around us. We don't feel we have any support. We feel, am I the only person who sees the world in this way? And one of the stories that I loved recently was a woman who got in touch from Australia who lived in a town, and she was saying, I'm the only person around here who's interested in this. No one else around here is interested in this. And so she put an advert in the local paper, I'm interested in transition. Is anybody else? And she got 120 replies from people, and completely changed the way that she thought about the place where she lived. But so transition has really been designed as that way of trying to do something with that. What else do we do with that? You know, maybe if we can pick it up and turn it around and bring people together and do something. And a while ago, I went to Spain. This is a place in Santander called El Mercado de la Esperanza, which means the market of hope. And I found it completely by accident. I got lost and I ended up wandering into this place. The downstairs was all fish caught from the sea nearby. The upstairs was all local breads, cheese, vegetables, local produce, and that kind of thing. If you took both halves and put them next to each other, they were about the same square meterage as a supermarket for a town of the same size we'd be here. The difference was that this supported 100 families. This was 100 families' livelihood. That money stayed locally. That money made jobs happen rather than that money just all being extracted like an extractive industry. And it was a fantastic thing to walk around. And there was a study that I read from New Orleans where they looked at two retail outlets of the same size, 179,000 square feet. One was a single supermarket, one was 100 independent businesses under the same roof. And the one with 100 independents in it turned over $105 million a year and cycled $34 million into the local economy. And the independent and the supermarket just turned over $50 million and cycled about $8 million into the local economy. So, you know, that's really, that kind of different economic model meets our needs in so many more ways. So I guess transition has really evolved kind of as the bits in the jigsaw puzzle. So no one would say that all we need is something like transition. We need all kinds of different things. We need national government, we need local government, we need business, we need everybody in the push. But there's something that we do when we come together that nobody else can do. It's the piece in the middle. It's the missing piece of the puzzle. And we see that again and again in different places. And you'll see the projects that I'm going to talk about, the stories I'm going to tell you, are things that only really happen when people come together. You couldn't legislate for them. You couldn't do them on your own, but you can do them, all those things that become possible when we get together with other people. So I've set out some very big challenges, I guess, some very big, kind of enormous challenges. So how on earth could something like transition actually ever hope to have any kind of meaningful impact on those? And what I want to present, I suppose, is my sort of thinking at the moment about how it might, how it could, how all these things could join up and actually represent something that is at scale in terms of a response to those challenges that we've talked about. But it starts with the groups. It starts with people coming together, meeting outside the school gates, meeting in the pub. They know each other already. They've seen something, they're inspired in some way to have a go at doing this. And that's really where it gets started. And the first Transition Thursday that was actually a Tuesday took place in Crystal Palace in London. And Transition Crystal Palace have been going for about 2 years, and they just had their second birthday. And this is them clearing an area of ground in a local park to turn it into a community garden. They started because there's just a few people came together, and it kind of grew from that. But in that time, they've created this community garden, which won the Mayor of London's Community Garden Award last year. They've created another 4 gardens through Crystal Palace. They've started Palace Power, which is a community-owned renewable energy company. They've started a new local food market in Crystal Palace, which has been a riotous success, and all the traders are sold out of everything by lunchtime. They've started something called the Palace Pint, where people grow hops throughout Crystal Palace in pub back gardens and in their own back gardens to flavour a Palace Pint that will be brewed in September. Beer will be a bit of a recurring theme. We'll come back to that during this evening. But it starts with those people, and it's designed around what people are passionate about. What do you care about? What it is you bring to it? If your passion is local food and growing food on balconies, you don't have to come and start an energy company. You do what it is that you're really passionate about. And that's what really shone through meeting them. The economic crisis in Portugal is horrendous, as it is in Spain and Greece and across southern Europe. In Portugal now, the average monthly wage is about €450, and the prices in the supermarket are about the same as what they are here. And so transition has emerged all over Portugal, but they work in a different way. If they put on a film and charge €5 to come and see a film, no one's really going to come. €5 is quite a lot of money. So they operate in a different way. They operate as a kind of a gift economy, and they really look at how they can do things without the need for money. This is in a place called Porto Alegre, and just out of the shot here is an apartment block, and just out of the shop over here is a shopping mall, a shopping precinct. This was a sort of a piece of ground that just had grass on it. The way that the transition group works there is that they say to people, tell us what you want to do, and we'll mobilise people to come and help. So the people in this apartment block said, we'd love to grow some food on there. And you might look at that and say, well, that's not going to feed Porto Alegre, is it? What's the point of that? It's not even going to feed one person living in there. But actually, when I spoke to a woman called Sonia, who was one of the people who got involved in it, she said, it's amazing. I've been living in Porto Alegre for forever, for 37 years, and I've felt my community and my city crumble, people turning their backs on each other. This community garden we created tells me that it's possible to do things with other people. It is possible. We just need to wake up to each other again. People found there's something to talk about with each other on the stairs. People found they had something in common again. And actually what it did was it became a catalyst for all kinds of other stuff. They started a place in the shopping centre called The Perch, where it was just a place where people could come and do stuff. They ran workshops, sort of free skilling workshops. And about 2 weeks ago, they ran this enormous event called Ayudada, which means gift or help, where about 1,000 people came together, and they ran a whole 3-day thing with nobody paying for anything. It was all run as a gift economy, the taxi drivers, the restaurants, everybody pitched in and ran an event modelling what it would look like if we looked at what resources mean in a different way. But it starts with a single thing. It starts with the thing that starts to give you the confidence that you can actually make a change happen. All too often, we just feel that it's not possible. This is in a place called Coin in Spain, and there was a guy called Jose, who was a fisherman, who got really excited about transition. So he got a load of people in Coin all fired up about transition, and being a fisherman, then he had to go away to sea for 4 months. So he went away to sea for 4 months, came back, and the whole thing had just run out of steam, flat as a pancake. So got him all fired up again, and started loads of more projects, went away for another 4 months, came back completely flat. So, right, I'm not having that again, we've had enough of this. So then he designed it, and they rejigged it, and really looked at that whole process. And now it kind of runs kind of well without him when he's away. And then one of the things they did was a local food market, and they've done a really great job of engaging the local farming community. And also the local council announced that due to their having absolutely no money, they were going to privatise the water. And as experience around the world tells you, when your water gets privatised, you're really in trouble. So within a week, they mobilised thousands of people with petitions and public meetings, and the council dropped the idea and said, well, work with us to design a different way to, around the water, which is a process going on at the moment. But when I talked to Jose, he said, people feel, and this might resonate with you a bit if you're doing this kind of thing, people feel there is a big shift happening, but they don't know what it's a shift to. I feel Coin in Transition's biggest achievement so far has been to catalyse an openness to this shift and its possibilities. And I think, you know, we talked about resilience, this idea of resilience, and there's lots of academic things about resilience. I increasingly think, for me, resilience is the degree to which a place feels it has possibilities. But when you encounter times of great difficulty, what do you feel you can do? What possibilities do you feel you have at your disposal? And that's one of the great things, I think, that the transition projects do. And it's not always those kind of nuts and bolts sort of practical stuff, I suppose. This is in Tooting and in London, and one of the lovely things about Transition Tooting is they kind of come at all this stuff more from an arts kind of angle. So rather than doing a local food campaign in Tooting, where they might be doing something around growing food in the window box or having cloth bags saying buy local or something, they run a thing called Foodival. Because if you walk down Tooting High Street, the idea of local food is kind of a strange concept, because pretty much every shop on Tooting High Street, everything in the shop is imported from the Indian subcontinent. So what does local food mean in that context? So what they do is they have people all over Tooting who grow food on balconies, on allotments, in back gardens. They bring all that produce down one weekend in September down to Tooting High Street, and the cooks cook it in Turkish, Kurdish, Pakistani, whatever, and give it away on the street to people as a way of doing that. This is one of the things that they do called the Transition Tooting Shop, where they took over an empty shop on Tooting High Street just for 9 days, and it was called the Shop with Nothing for Sale but Lots on Offer. And the idea was they created a space where you could just drop in and just talk about what Tooting means to you. What does it mean? What does it mean to live here? What do you love about this place? What's special about it? Why do you care about it? And they created this incredible kind of space for that period of time. And Transition can do that kind of stuff really beautifully as well, I think. One of the things that's been really incredible, having started something in a little town in Devon, is seeing where it's gone. So it started there. There's now transition stuff happening in 43 countries around the world, in thousands of initiatives. And increasingly, and the thing I love about it is that it's not like a Coca-Cola franchise. It's not like if you start transition in Poland, it's like an English thing. It feels like a Polish thing. This is in Brazil, and transition landed in Brazil and just went absolutely everywhere. There's transition projects all over the place in Brazil. And this is in Brasilândia, which is one of the favelas in São Paulo. And they've developed ways of teaching transition stuff to people who can't read. And there they haven't done it on the basis of peak oil and climate change, because the peak oil, as far as Brazil is concerned, they're the new Saudi Arabia of the world, or are shortly to become so. It's designed around social justice, around empowerment for women, about addressing issues around violence, poverty. And so they've started all kinds of social enterprises there in the favela, a new bakery, a filmmaking company, making bags and clothes out of old materials that they get there. And this is working with local school children to make a garden. But it was always really designed in that kind of way that anyone anywhere could pick it up. It's like an open source thing. You pick it up, you take it, you make it your own. So if I visit transition projects in different parts of the world, it's always recognisably transition, but it's always distinct to the place as it should be. And another one of the things I love about it is how it's like a research and development network of research and development units. So if somewhere comes up with a good idea, it can just be replicated all over the place, like a learning network. It's one of the things about resilience that's really great. How do we roll these ideas out? So, for example, in Brixton, they did a thing called Draft Busters, which they developed as a way where you get together with people where you are, and somebody hosts like a Tupperware party. You have a draft proofing party. People come round to your house and you draft proof someone's house. You have a few glasses of wine. You get to meet each other, and you go home with all the stuff to draft proof your own house. And then if you want to hold a draft proofing party, you do one as well. So for the councils, you had all this money for draft proofing that no one was really taking up, because councils are kind of a bit dull, really, when they put that stuff out. Actually, if it's in the guy next door saying, I'm having a draft proofing party, you go around and you draft proof the house. One of the things that we developed in Totnes was called Transition Streets. And that was the idea that, well, maybe if we want to get energy reduction happening across, and we want to get that kind of insulation stuff happening, we need a different way to do it. It was in the paper today, I saw on Twitter or somewhere, that so far 4 households in the UK have signed up to the Green New Deal, or something absolutely pathetic. We developed Transition Streets in Totnes based on the idea that you get people together. You have a simple kind of guide, you have some support, you get out on your streets, you knock on the door, you get 6 to 10 of your neighbours to say, yeah, we'd like to do that. You're meeting each other's houses for 7 times. First week you get to know each other, second week you look at energy, you learn about how the energy works in your house, you decide you're going to make some changes, you come back. There's a little bit of kind of peer pressure, because you want to come back and impress the people who you've come with. We did it, it won the Ashton Award for Behaviour Change 2 years ago. And in Totnes now, about 700 households have done it. And on average, they've cut their carbon emissions by about 1.3 tonnes a house. That saved themselves about £600. But the thing, when I meet people in the street who've done it, nobody says, it's quite galling actually, because it kind of was the point. Nobody comes up and says, it's great, Rob, I saved 1.3 tonnes of carbon. They all say, yeah, it's great, I know Sandra over the road. I know she could do that. And there's Dave down there, and we're doing this, that, and the other. So a lot of the groups had so much fun meeting each other, they carried on meeting after the thing had finished. Some of them carried on meeting and started a community orchard. One of them started a community cinema. You know, and it's bringing people together. It's fantastic. And again, it's one of those ideas that has just spread off and replicated. There's lots of places doing it now. And someone sent me the link to this the other day. This is in Newcastle, in Australia. And they've started doing transition streets across Newcastle in Australia. And one of the stories that they told was about on this street, it's very inner city street, and over here there's a big student house who had always been seen as a bit of a problem before. They kept very different hours to everybody else, and they were noisier and slightly messier than everybody else. And so there was a kind of, there'd always been a bit of sort of hostility between them. And actually they got the student house involved in transition streets, and through that they all kind of came to realise, well, because they're up and about later, actually, they kind of keep more of an eye on the place at that time when we were all in bed, and there'd been quite a lot of antisocial behaviour around the area and stuff. What they found was when they started to put everybody back together again, actually there was about 4 or 5 times when people were in danger of being mugged or whatever, and the students came out from the student house and kind of sorted it out. And all these other kind of unexpected benefits started to spin off just because people were actually back talking together. And they happen to be cutting their carbon emissions and doing all that kind of stuff as well. Again, that's something that's very hard for government to do. That's something that we can do, because we are kind of working that way. So that bit of transition, which is the sort of people coming together and starting to do stuff, maybe doesn't work everywhere, and maybe people may need more support with it, but actually it feels like we have something there which works, can work. The second bit is then, how do we then start to turn that into creating livelihoods for people? Because actually, a lot of us who do this stuff are doing it in our Wednesday evenings, as well as raising a family, as well as having a job. You know, actually, wouldn't it be lovely if actually transition could become your job? And this whole economy needs to actually be creating livelihoods for people. So this, what we call it re-economy. And we have there's a whole strand of the work of Transition Network, which is about how we do that, how we support people who are doing transition to turn their ideas into enterprises, into creating a new economy. This is in Dunbar in Scotland, and Sustaining Dunbar one of the first things they did, they call a local resilience action plan, where they spoke to 1,500 people across Dunbar. What's your vision? What do you want Dunbar to do? And then from that, they've done all kinds of different things. One of them is this, which is a community bakery, which raised about £40,000 in share capital to get it started from 624 people. The bakery now employs 8 people, and the average age of people working in the bakery is 23. And they're a really great sort of success story about what a community can do when it puts its money together. And I think as well, you know, we have this idea very often. I don't know how I got invited to it, but a while ago I got invited to speak at a conference in Manchester on what was called place branding, which I never even knew about place branding before. So place branding is some kind of art where one city will sort of, you know, I don't know, whatever, Sheffield is the city of something or other.
City of steel.
Yeah, but does it have a more kind of recent sort of... Is that green spaces. Oh, so Manchester, so Plymouth is the city of enterprise. And Somerset, I don't know, is a county of cheese or something. You know, but everywhere, you kind of give yourself this thing, which means you're trying to get inward investment. We're all obsessed with inward investment. But actually, what about internal investment? And how we spend our money and invest our money in ways that can actually drive it. So where we have money, if we can make it cycle locally as many times as possible before it leaves, that makes a big difference. This is in Slawit in Yorkshire, and their greengrocer shut down. And the community came together, and within 3 weeks they'd raised £15,000 in shares and got the shop back open again as a cooperative. And the great thing about it is that rather than just being a shop, it's been a real catalyst for all kinds of other stuff. They found when they were running their own shop that all the garlic available to you as a wholesaler came from China. They thought, this is mad. People have grown garlic in this valley historically. So one of the first things they did was on the counter, they had a bowl, they called it the Slawit Garlic Challenge. So every time you came in the shop and did your shopping, they gave you 2 cloves of garlic to take them home, grow them, they'll buy them back off you. If nothing else, would be self-sufficient in garlic within a year or two. But the shop has then been a catalyst for a cooperative growing food to supply the shop. There's a bakery that started up, the Handmade Bakery, who are a really nice model of a community-supported bakery. So they started out baking bread for a membership. They had a membership base who they baked for. And so it meant that then when they wanted to expand the business, they needed to borrow £40,000. They went to the bank who wanted an enormous amount of interest. It meant they could actually go out to their members and say, please lend us £40,000. We'll pay you 7% interest, very attractive these days, but we'll pay you the interest in bread. They call it a bread bond. So it cost them about 2%. And I think what we're seeing in transition that I find really fascinating is people who have no, who don't have a background in running a business, getting started with doing it. This is in Matlock, in Derbyshire. Some of you might be from near that way. And this is DE4 Food, which is a social enterprise that started there. The Transition Matlock had a food group, and one of their first projects, they decided they were going to do a food directory. So they very keenly dashed out with their clipboards and going around and trying to find out who was around that they could talk to, what local food projects were there. And they found such a poor number of local food projects that they were just embarrassed and they didn't actually even end up putting a food directory out. And one of the problems was that the way the land is there, that actually most of the arable land is used for lambs and sheep. There's not much that's actually used for growing vegetables. There weren't any organic growers as such. But all the vegetables were grown in people's back gardens. So they thought, well, how do we have a model that can actually engage that kind of food and tie it in with everything else? So they started DE4 Food, which is a food hub. And it enables that kind of patchwork farming where you have people growing veg all across who can then fit them in. So it's an online thing. And if Chrissy has grown 5 lettuce he wants to sell, and George has got a few of the leeks he wants to sell, they all put them into the system. And then you just go shopping online as if you would have anything. And you don't know whether it's coming from a back garden or whether it's coming from a farm. And then you just get delivered your box. But it means that as a grower, you've sold everything when you put it into the system. The great thing was they all said, we'd spent all our lives up to that point doing everything we could to get away from the idea of ever running a business. Ever. You know, profit and loss, what? And they learned to do it by... The first thing they did was they did a lamb CSA, where they helped a local farmer with lambing, and in return he said that they could have half the lamb at the end of the process. So then they had that, and then it's grown and grown, and it's a really lovely model. Again, very replicable. You can pick this up. But that idea of bringing back gardens in commercially is really good. This is one of my favourite stories. And it's a really nice example, I think, of how you never know the power of what you do. When you do something with an intention, with a spark, that you think, yeah, that's got to happen, I'm going to make that happen, you never know where it's going to go. You never know where that story is going to go. About 5 years ago, I walked into an old building in Totnes to go and see a guy who makes films. And the building used to be the bank in Totnes about 100 years ago. So hanging on the wall, he had an 1810 Totnes banknote, £1, issued by the Bank of Totnes. And I thought, what if we printed some of ours? Could you do that? And so, and we formed this kind of advisory panel of the great and the good of kind of alternative economists and said, can we do that? And they said, no idea. We're right behind you. See what happens. But you know, you want an advisory panel right behind you. You want them kind of alongside you. That's not really a good idea. So anyway, so we printed about 300 new notes, and some shops said they'd take them, and then it's grown and grown, and it's inspired other places to do it. And the one I think that is really exciting is Bristol. This is George Ferguson, who's the new mayor of Bristol, wearing his trademark red trousers, which he always wears, apart from last week when it was Bristol Green, Nick Lemon wore a pair of green trousers. And he's the recently elected mayor of Bristol. And on his inauguration, in his inauguration speech about 8 months ago, he announced he would be taking his full salary in Bristol pounds. The most incredible kind of vote of confidence for the scheme. You can now pay your council tax in Bristol pounds. If you're a trader, you can pay your business rates in Bristol pounds. If you rent a stall from the council, you can pay your rental in Bristol pounds. What they have there, which they've developed, was originally developed and piloted in Brixton for the Brixton pound, and which you now have in Bristol, is a pay-by-text system, which Transition Network and New Economics Foundation developed as an open-source thing. It can be used anywhere. It can be used here if you want to use it. Where you walk in the shop, you can only use it in independent local retailers, and you text the shopkeeper, his phone goes ping, and that's your payment done. And the notes are beautiful, and in the bits on normal banknotes where it says signed by the governor of the Bank of England, it says signed by the people of Bristol. But these things are really, the exciting thing about the Bristol pound is it is at scale. It's at a scale where you can really start to see how something like that might work. It's inspiring other places. Oxford are now thinking about doing it. Cardiff are very keen. Lots of places are starting to get in touch. And I think that idea, it's not about turning your back on the rest of the world. It's not a kind of isolationist thing. It's about celebrating what you love about the place where you live, and that needs a bit of a hand. That 3% economy we talked about at the beginning, it needs a hand. And if you go shopping with Bristol pounds, you still come home. If you take 50 Bristol pounds shopping, you still come home with £50 worth of shopping. But what you leave behind you is money that can only cycle locally and only do good things in that place, and particularly with all the scandals that we see about what happens to our money otherwise, that's really important, I think. And I mentioned before about how transition has kind of gone off all over the place. One of the first transition project in Japan was in a place called Fujino. And Transition Fujino were really interested in renewables. And they started running workshops about how to make solar panels, and they kind of started collecting solar panels, and they were kind of quite into it, but it was kind of a hobby thing, I suppose. And then there was the tsunami in 2011, and they weren't affected directly, but nearby there were communities that were just trashed by the tsunami, and they lost all of their infrastructure, their electricity and everything. One of the things that's very important to communities there is what's called a Festival of Light that happens every year. And so Transition Fujino loaded all their solar stuff on the back of a truck and drove down to those areas and used that to enable those places to run the festivals of light that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do. And then when they came back, they were so kind of taken with the power of doing that, literally and metaphorically, that actually they decided they wanted to start the Fujino Electric Company. Community-owned renewable energy company. What's fantastic is that inspired by what they've done in Fujino, there's now 40 of these community electric companies popped up all across Japan. And these ideas, they kind of when they sometimes they just hit the right time. And that's happening here as well. This guy here is called Agamemnon Otero. And he's the only Agamemnon I've ever met in my life. And he's fantastic. And the guy is on fire. And this is in Brixton. So this picture is taken on the top of a very tall tower block in the middle of Brixton. And what we're up there to look at is, firstly, this here. This is Brixton Energy Solar 1. And this is Brixton Energy Solar 2. So Brixton Energy grew out of Transition Brixton as a community-owned energy company. It's a cooperative. So Brixton Energy Solar 1, they issued a share launch. And they invited people in Brixton to buy shares and to make their own energy company, to invest in this. The first share launch that they did, you reckon about 60-70% was kind of white middle class, sort of green, trendy Brixton people. And the rest, a little bit, came from on the estate, not that much. So by the time they did Brixton Energy Solar 2, 60% of the money came from people on the estate. And quite a lot came from people in the buildings. Because you could move, and people were moving their money out of an ISA and putting it into this. The return was better, and they could see good things happening around them. Installing it meant that they were training young kids off the estate in how to install solar. They generated a fund for making the buildings more energy efficient. Incredible project. But the thing that got me, they just launched Brixton Energy 3 on a building over here somewhere. And they reckoned that for Brixton Energy Solar 3, the vast majority of that money is going to come from people on the estate. Because the word is out, this is good. This is a really good thing. This is really good for this estate. But the thing that got me most was when we were standing up here, Agamemnon's thing was, we're going to do all of this. There wasn't any sense of, well, we'll have a go anyway. We're going to do all of this. There's no reason why we can't do the whole, all these rooftops are potentially owned by the community. You know, if we want to kind of drive renewables, you know, we can't do all of it as communities, because the scale of the renewable infrastructure we need to put in is such that even if we put in our pensions and all our savings and everything we get our hands on, it's probably going to be about a quarter of the total. But that's a hell of a lot that we can own and benefit from and invest in and use to drive other stuff that happens in the places where we live. And that idea of internal investment that I talked about before, one of the best examples of that is in Bath. So Bath and West Community Energy came from a merging of the energy groups of Transition Bath and Transition Caution. And they quite early on met with the people from Scottish and Southern Energy, one of the big six energy companies. A really interesting model they had there, where Scottish and Southern invested £1 million in them to get them going at quite a favourable kind of a rate, which meant that they were able to do a share launch where quite a lot of community energy share launches say, we'll give you some interest, we'll give you some money back at some point when we can. They were able to say, we'll give you 6-point-something% from the end of the first year. So it was a model that gave people the confidence to move their savings. Lots of people moved their self-invested pensions into a community-owned energy company. It meant when they did their first share launch about a year and a half ago, they raised £750,000 in shares from local people, which then gave the council the confidence to invest another £2 million into it. Then we start to see the models where that money is able to really go in and drive this process. A similar example I read recently about Nottingham University Hospital Trust, who looked at how they were spending money on food and decided that rather than spending the £2 million they spent producing 5,000 meals a day just through wholesalers and whatever, that they were going to do it themselves through local farmers. They now source 90% of all the fresh fruit and vegetables from local farmers from within 30 miles, and the same with the meat. And that's an injection of £2 million into the local economy every year. That doesn't mean, that's not a retreat from progress. That's not some kind of, harking back to some halcyon days. That's the economy of the future. That's the economy that actually meets our needs much, much more than the one that's currently on offer, I would argue. So we've got a couple of things. We've got people coming together, starting transition going. Then we've got the idea of, okay, well, how might we kind of start to turn this into livelihoods and so on? The next bit, I think, and there are four bits to it, so this is the third, is about how do we really argue the case for that economically? Because usually in this world of kind of people who argue that local economies are really good and community resilience and stuff, we kind of say we should because it's a good idea. We never really have the financial case to support that. One of the things that Transition Network did recently is two of these. There's a third one coming from Brixton. So we've looked at a market town, a county, and an urban neighbourhood. The idea is to map where all the money goes. Where do we spend all our money every year? Where does it all go? So we now know, for example, that in Totnes we spend £30 million on food every year, of which £22 million goes out through just two supermarkets, £17.5 million through one supermarket. And we have a much bigger, stronger local food culture than most other places do. So that's £22 million running through our fingers like sand every year. We could be staying locally. If we could just shift 10% of what we spend on food, as individuals in our weekly shopping, as organisations procuring stuff, schools or whatever, that's £2 million coming into the local economy. Where else is that going to come from? When you look on the scale of Herefordshire, it's £156 million a year that's spent on food that leaves through supermarkets. So actually, then you start to really build an economic case. And then we also looked at renewable energy, the potential from renewable energy, from retrofitting buildings, and from caring for the elderly in a different way. And there's a potential £5.5 million that at the moment is just passing us by. Then we shift from community resilience being a nice idea to being a form of economic development. And then lastly, is really about, okay, if, as this grows, how do we actually kind of bring some investment in to drive this forward? And I meet people who run big sort of philanthropic trusts who have a big endowment which is largely invested in things that are trashing the planet, and then they get the interest to give away to organisations to try and make it better again. It's a fairly silly model, really. And actually, what would it look like if you had a model where they could invest into this kind of economy coming through? There's a lot of talk about social return on investment. Well, this is sort of starting to really model what that could look like if you could bring that investment. And one of the projects that I'm involved in is the Atmos project in Totnes, where we're trying to bring this 8-acre derelict former milk processing plant into community ownership. And we're nearly there. It's taken 6 years. And we're nearly there in terms of signing a contract for a community-led master planning for this site. One of the powers that the government gave in the Localism Act was called a community right to build order. They said if a community could mobilise and master plan a site and then run a referendum and get more than 50% in a referendum, that's planning permission. It's an alternative route to planning permission. And we're going to be doing that later this year on this site. But being able to have access to investment to drive these kind of things, because I don't see there's any reason why, if we can do it right, why we can't become our own developers. Development tends to be something that happens to communities, and increasingly it feels like, those of you who've read the Harry Potter books, you know, developers feel increasingly like there's sort of dementors flying around the edge of your community, sort of sucking the value out of everything, while we just get left with whatever's left over afterwards. So bringing that kind of investment in, and then maybe we start to get something that could be proportionate to the scale of what we're talking about. If you've got communities mobilising, starting these kind of things going, these projects going that are creating livelihoods for people, we're able to look at it strategically, how it all hangs together, and then bring some finance in to support it, then I think we have something really exciting that could actually be proportionate. And one of the great privileges that I have working with Transition Network is that I get to see all the stuff that gets sent in from all around the world of what people are doing. And I quite often get asked, so what's transition then? And it's always, and I've been asking people here today to make little films of people's response to that. And there were this woman in Vancouver, she was asked what for her, how would she summarise the essence of transition? And she said, meet your neighbours, see what happens. Which I thought was as nice as anything I'd ever come up with of years of doing this. So the last little bit, I wanted to come back to this again, to our stickered shops in Belfast. Because the thing that struck me after a little while, once the shock and the indignation had worn off of reading the story, was the thing that I thought was most interesting was that the kind of stickers that were put on the window to make the G8 think everything was all right, these weren't Sainsbury's local. They didn't make a Photoshop Sainsbury's local. They didn't make a Photoshop Tesco Express or an Aldi or a Travel Lodge. What they made was an independent butcher's shop with windows full of meat and delicious sort of diversity of stuff where you could go in and taste it. There's a friendly butcher's, well, half a hair friendly butcher there behind the counter. You know, that kind of, and it made me think, actually, if you, even the G8, if you've got the G8, G8 ministers on their own after a couple of glasses of Bollinger in the golf club there in Enniskillen, this is what they like to walk down. Actually, this is what we all like to see as a kind of economy around us, because it's a human scale economy. It nourishes us better. It meets all our needs better. So which of the two do we want to grow? And how do we put our shoulder to making that happen, to push the 3% to 5% or a 10%? And so the theme about the power of just doing stuff, I wanted to just introduce you to something, my bit of doing stuff that we did yesterday. So I'm involved with a project to start a community brewery, a social enterprise brewery in the place where I live. And so we had the Totnes launch of the book yesterday. And to do that, we've launched the very first beer, which is called The Power of Just Brewing Stuff. And we only had 70 bottles, and they were sold out in about 10 minutes. But this is, you know, it's nice. This is my own kind of story. This is what fires me up. I'm really excited about the idea of putting that piece of infrastructure back. My town used to have a brewery up until 1921, and then it closed down and it was all sold off. But what would it look like if you had a brewery, a social enterprise, that was set up in order to try and grow that 3% economy, to trigger a new culture of entrepreneurship in the place? Could it be that you issue a number of limited edition bottled beers, and each one that you bring out tells a story about somebody in that town who's trying to start a business? So this beer is about Dave's. Then he wants to start a market garden and needs £1,000. 20 pence from every bottle goes towards Dave starting his market garden. So just by supporting that business, you're always kind of building up a portfolio of enterprises that you're supporting. Finding different ways to do that. One of the things that we do every year is called the Local Entrepreneurs Forum. And what we do is we bring together people who want to start businesses, together with people who are potential mentors, people who may be retired or have experience in business they'd like to share, and people who are potential investors. We spend a day sort of cross-pollinating them and getting them all meeting each other. And then at the end, we do what's called a community of dragons. And rather than the dragons done on television, where five astonishingly arrogant people sit on a stage behind vast piles of cash and either belittle and humiliate or throw money at whoever walks through the door, the version that we do is based on the idea that everybody in this community is a potential investor in the future of this place. Whether you've got £5, whether you can lend someone a pen, whether you've got a field, whether you're a designer who'll do a leaflet for them, we're all investors in making that economy happen. So what happens is four or five people get up, they pitch their enterprise, they present what they want to do, they state what they need, people ask them questions. And then when that's all done, then people pitch, I'll give you £100. I'll give you £50 if five other people do. I've got a field you can have. You can use my building. Incredible. We had a business who wanted to start a community-supported agriculture scheme. They already had one. They wanted to expand it. They needed £1,000. They went away with £3,500. Someone offering to make a free promotional video for them. They went away with 30 members before they'd even launched their membership. They went away with all kinds of different things. And that's what it looks like when a community comes together to support its entrepreneurs, to make this kind of thing happen. And this is just a little bit that I'm sort of playing a part in, trying to... And it was very nice beer as well.
Thank you.
So that's me. If you want to find out anything else about Transition, there's various things. And transitionnetwork.org, there's a thing on the front page called Transition Near Me. And you type in your postcode and it'll tell you the people, the projects, the initiatives that are happening near you. Thank you very much for listening. And you can ask some questions. Thank you very much.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle is flowing down down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.